we've been talking together through the whole last month about the foundational ethical practice as described by the Buddha, commonly called the five precepts or the five lay precepts, which are the guidelines for all practitioners, both monastic and non-monastic, which is what the word lay refers to, but which are really considered to be the foundation of lay people's practice. And along with taking refuge, are, in a sense, if you were to ask many Asian Buddhists, South Asian Buddhists, what the heart of Buddhist practice was, you would hear refuge and precepts as the centerpiece, really, of what we as non-monastics would practice. And many people would also meditate, but it's not assumed that meditation is the center of the practice. The centrality of the precepts goes back all the way to the Buddha's description of what he called a gradual path to liberation, where our orientation first is shifted by means of taking refuge away from the distractions and hooks and pulls of ordinary life, and particularly away from the belief that we can find lasting satisfaction through achieving the things we desire. And so refuge, as the word implies, suggests that there's a place that is safe for us, we could think like psychically almost, to reside in the world where we're sheltered somewhat from its obsessive pressures. And the pressures, again, manifest through us as desire, as fear, as aggression. As, in a sense, a perversion of the natural self-defense reflexes, right? So as we're animals out in the wild, appropriate fear is the startle and fight-flight response in relation to threat, right? Appropriate shutdown is sleep and deactivation when I'm in a safe space. Appropriate overwhelm is the system shutting down in the presence of mortal threat in order to preserve basic organ function, right? Shock, what we would call shock or trauma. All of these are natural systems, right? The desire for pleasure, the aversion to pain are natural organismic responses to being in an ecosystem. But the Buddha recognizes, as all of the early yogic systems recognize, that these, what I would now call kind of natural systems, that's from the trauma work a little bit perspective, get perverted, or we could almost say metastasize, into overwrought or too strong versions of themselves, right? The appropriate fear of a predator that keeps me safe can become like fearful anxiety that I carry all the time, every day, right? The natural overwhelm that is shock that protects my body from intense pain when injured and should wear off can metastasize into an ongoing overwhelm where I'm slightly shut down all the time, right? This is probably the most pervasive nervous system quality I see in everyone I work with who lives in a fast modern society as we do, as pretty much everyone around here does, is a little overwhelm. And I know it intimately myself. So, the beginning of the gradual path is the taking of refuge in an aspect of existence that is not desire, satisfaction, self-protection oriented. So refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we talked about a couple months ago. I'll return to them in upcoming weeks. And actually, kind of at the end of the summer, we'll find a date for it. A couple folks here have asked about doing a formal refuge ceremony, which is a really simple ritual of taking refuge in a traditional way that is really quite beautiful and can be a powerful way to sort of magically or ritually or energetically connect yourself with these teachings if you feel refuge arising naturally in you. So we can do this beautiful ritual. We'll do one of these later in the summer. So the first step is taking refuge. And the second step is, in a sense, once we plant ourselves in a realm of a kind of psychic safety, and that safety is also not just psychological, but it's really communal. The third of the refuges is in community. So we establish ourselves in the refuge of a safe community as best we can. We then have the conditions to investigate the causes of our distress, of our stress. And as we begin that investigation, immediately what arises is that what we suffer from is in large part relational. It's about how we exist with other people, how we influence other people, how our actions affect ourselves and others. And so then the first practice to take on is the discipline of beginning to inquire into our actions and their results. And so the list of the precepts, ethical guidelines, it sounds like a list of thou shalt nots, right? Don't kill, don't steal, don't misuse sex, speech, and alcohol are the five in essence. But what they turn into, what we've been talking about all month as we've looked at each of them in turn, we've looked at out of order, we looked at numbers 3, 2, and then 4. Now we're on 5, we'll do number 1 next week, is that they, first of all, they're impossible, right? The precept to refrain from taking that which is not offered to me, as soon as we actually look at our economy, look at how goods and money and services work, look at the very intimate interchange of our body with the ecosystem, we realize that we take all sorts of things that weren't offered, right? By using the resources of the planet around us in various ways. And that it's not that that's the problem, but that the precept actually points us toward the harm and distress that is a natural aspect of existing in an ecosystem, existing in a complex system, that there's no pure refuge in the world of action. In that sense, the precepts solidify refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, because if we really investigate them and look at our actions, we find that there's not a refuge actually in purity of action, because it can't be attained when we're working with the external. So they're paradoxical at their base. But that said, they exist in a very concrete way, especially in the early tradition. And one of the ways that they are described is as gifts. There's a text from the collection of discourses known as the Collection of Lists of Eight Things. This is the Book of the Eights in the Anguttara Nikaya, or the numbered discourses. And it says there are eight great gifts, or eight divine gifts. And those eight gifts are the three refuges and the five precepts. And the language that it uses is the one who keeps these precepts, and it goes through each one in turn, gives a gift to other beings of freedom from fear, aggression, and oppression. Fear, hostility, and oppression. And that's the primary reason given in this particular text for the precepts. In other texts, there's a discussion of the meditative life and the realization that if the mind or heart is consumed with regret for past actions and swirling with worry and fear about the effects of one's own actions, it's hard to get quiet in meditation. Any of you who have sat long enough to have gone through what's called a life review, which every once in a while shows up, where, you know, every stupid thing you've ever done kind of just pops up on the screen and says, well, and then I did that. Oh, and then that, you know, in various categories, that will happen eventually. I think it's the psyche's way of kind of processing unprocessed stuff in the past. The text says, you know, keep the precepts really literally, and you'll have less of that to process in the future. It gives rise to a very nice state that translates, a really sweet phrase that translates as the bliss of blamelessness. Like, you know you did your darn best, and so you can experience a quality called blamelessness. You can't be blamed for your actions. Now, that doesn't mean that things turned out the way we all want, right? And it's a point of importance in current oppression work to recognize the difference between intention and result. And that one can have a very sincere good intention and the result can still be harmful. And that's part of what we reckon with as we practice with the precepts. Right. So that said, as a basis, that the definition of the precepts is that they are a gift that provides or that offers freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression to others. When your actions are in the direction of supporting well-being, others feel safer around you, or the conditions are there for others to feel safer around you. Others are also subject to their own conditions. They may or may not actually feel safe, but your part is to act clearly. With that as the foundation, then, this fifth precept, it literally translates as abstaining from fermented and distilled liquor that clouds the mind and causes heedlessness. Yes, abstention from fermented and distilled liquors that cloud the mind and cause heedlessness. So we do not need to do a show of hands to say how many of us have ever been heedless as a basis of fermented or distilled liquor. But you know it exists, and it causes tremendous amounts of harm. So a couple of things that we can look at in this suggestion for something that is tremendously important in as a basis for practice. One is that the phrase causes heedlessness in a certain way implies that the thing that happens when we drink, and I'll keep it to drink for a few minutes here and then we'll blow it out to other kinds of intoxicants. But one of the things that happens when we drink, and that I think is particular to alcohol, is that often, not always, but often, the social restraints that we've been conditioned to apply to our actions tend to soften or loosen, right? It's a social lubricant. We feel more at ease with others. And as we know, perhaps from our experience or from others' experience, our judgment around what's appropriate to do or say or act on with others, really in relationship, can become flawed. We can perceive incorrectly. In the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, two of the five types of mental pattern, chittavritti, are correct perception and wrong perception. So one of the things that the intoxicant does is that it clouds our correct perception, right? It was just really fun to say that completely atrocious thing at the family gathering. Well, I was drunk, you know. It just felt funny at the time. But actually, it was really hurtful, right? My perception was clouded. My mind was clouded such that I couldn't perceive the effects, the potential effects of my actions. So heedlessness in some way is the breaking of the first four precepts. So what this fifth one does is it makes it harder to keep the first four, right? Not causing physical harm, not causing property harm, not causing sexual harm, not causing verbal or speech communication harm. We say the wrong things, we flirt with the wrong person, we take the wrong stuff, and we hurt people, right? Whether intentionally or unintentionally. So one piece of this is that it's even more than some of the other precepts, it's really talking about respecting very profoundly the truth of karma, or kamma in Pali, the natural relationship between actions and their results. It says actions have results. Those results matter because they can be harmful or not harmful to beings. They can be harmful or helpful even to beings. And to the extent that a substance, fermented and distilled liquor, literally, clouds my ability to perceive what the effects of my actions might be, that we could call heedlessness, not paying attention. It's a kind of distraction in a way, right? It's a kind of distracted or proliferating mind state that happens. And then these first four precepts that really speak to the possibility of profound harm causing to others can be broken. So this is one piece about heedlessness. And many of the traditional teachers speak very passionately about the necessity of absolute abstention. Just, you know, no fuzzy boundaries around this thing. Because I think the very nature of heedlessness is that it clouds our ability to be discerning in relation to our state, right? And so much in this practice is about shepherding our states of body and mind, right? Is my mind clear? Is my mind confused? Am I hooked into desire for something? Am I free from desire for something? Am I hooked into aversion or anger or fear about something? Am I free from that? So we're tracking our state all the time, in a sense, as mindfulness or clear awareness grows. So then the intoxicant can disturb that discernment to the extent that, in a way, it's not safe to rely on our judgment when on it at all. This is, now I'm starting with the most sort of traditional kind of fundamentalist teaching. So there you go. Don't do it. Just say no, Nancy Reagan. Now let's go further with it. It's interesting to me that the precept is literally about alcohol. India is not a very alcoholic culture, especially in this 1,000-some years after the Buddha. The waves of Muslim invasion and empire would really tamp down any tendency toward alcohol. Islam is a very anti-alcohol, generally, religion. And the Indian religious towns, and both Hindu and Muslim and otherwise, tend to be pretty dry places. And the religious towns are absolutely dry and vegetarian. So it's actually quite hard to get a drink nowadays in India. It's not actually that hard at all, but it's traditionally not as easy, certainly, as it would be here. So it's curious that the ban is alcohol. I have a historical wondering myself that that I actually sort of spent some time this afternoon trying to find an answer to historically and couldn't find anything. It turns out in piles of references to the precepts and to this precept that I could find, all of them were almost ridiculously simple and literal and like half a paragraph long. In other words, I can't find any sustained scholastic discussion of the origin of this thing. And granted, that was in like half an hour of Google scholaring. I could do better. And now I'm curious, so I'll let you know. I'll do a little more. But it wasn't even half an hour. It was really like 5 to 10 minutes, really. And then I looked in a bunch of books that I had, And I found, you know, very literal kind of descriptions. So I have a couple speculations. So on the record, here are my speculations. One is that the use of medicinal herbs, and particularly cannabis, and Central Asia is the origin of cannabis, goes back, as far as we know, deep into the Indian historical spiritual life. The precept doesn't mention it. I'm not going to make a conclusion out of that, but I'm curious that it's literally about alcohol and not other things, and it could have been phrased differently. I have no idea whether that's a meaningful distinction or not, historically. But as I reflect, and if I reflect now, let's open it from alcohol to other intoxicants, right? Often, especially in the West, Western spiritual teachers will teach this precept as if what it means is be mindful with the use of all altering substances. And we have access to a perhaps, you know, much vaster medicine chest of altering substances than our Indian forebears did, including some that they may not have dreamed of, you know. And of course, there's the great story of, you know, Ram Dass giving an entire vial of, you know, 1969 LSD to Neem Karoli Baba. And that was strong stuff back then. It was direct from Leary's lab and from Hoffman, you know, da-da-da, the story. And Neem Karoli Baba is like give me everything you got. And Ram Dass is like, this is really, man? You know, and he's like, good. Pops the whole thing. And, you know, Ram Dass and the Westerners are like, And nothing happens. He goes away. He goes into his cabin. He comes out a little while later, and they're like, what, man? What's it like? What do you think? And he just starts laughing. He's like, you guys, sure, you know, it's a realm. Maybe you need this. Like, grow up. Was sort of the impression that Ram Dass gives. Basically, like, and this is an assumption, this is Ram Dass's Westernist assumption, like, he was in those states all the time, that he didn't need it. I have no idea whether that's true. I don't know what his experience was. It does seem like, from the story, that, like, at the very least, his witness awareness was really clear through that experience. Beyond that, you'd have to, you know, he didn't describe what it was like for him. Clearly, it wasn't that important to him or much of a big deal. He kind of was just laughing at his hippies during it. But in every culture in the world, there is sacred ritualized use of state-altering substances, including alcohol, although not as much, as far as I know. I can think of a few alcohol-based rituals that aren't particularly shamanic. I don't know of any shamanic cultures that use alcohol as the core substance. Let me know if you do. I don't. But I know of other things, a lot of plant-based substances. So this makes me think, in a sense, and many of these substances have very, very wide effect. Some of them are not social lubricants. Some of them are, you know, as you may know, right, some of them are kind of psychological agents, some of them are sort of mental agents, some of them are very body, they do a lot of different things. So I don't actually know what the Buddha sort of intended in relation to that full breadth of activity. Other than we do get the sense that, you know, reliance on anything is, in a sense, a crutch. And there's a great text where the Buddha says to a minister comes from a certain king and says, you know, blessed one, like, what's so great about this life you live? You live in a hut in the woods. You live on alms. Like, my guy, the king, he lives in a palace. It's comfortable. He's got girls. He's got money. He's got the whole deal. Wouldn't that be preferable? You know, wouldn't you like that? And the Buddha says, oh, let me ask you a question. Can your king, with all of these sort of privileges, can he, anytime he wants, abide for as long as he wants in states of absolute bliss and pleasure and freedom from distress anytime he wants, for as long as he wants. And the minister honestly says, well, no, you know, like he's a king, but he's subject to all the same stuff as everybody, right? He gets sick, he doesn't get what he wants, da-da-da-da, he has moods. And the Buddha says, basically, well, I can. And what he's referring to is meditative bliss. He's referring to samadhi, or deep meditative states that are tremendously pleasurable. And he praises the value of that pleasure. But he says this is a pleasure that's not dependent on sense contact. So it's a pleasure that he can attain simply through the stabilization of the thinking mind, the somatic mind, rather than by making contact with any sensory stimulus at all. So any substance or any contact, visual, etc. So there is a sense in the texts of valuing highly those states that aren't dependent on any external, that in quotation marks, support, right? And that said, you know, huge amounts of the practice are devoted to creating good external supports, right? Living in solitude, eating simply, renouncing wants, being celibate, getting ordained, all the sort of fabulous things you can do that create the conditions for a very still mind. So it's not that he's against conditions, but he wants us to watch out for getting hooked into thinking that we need a certain thing in order to feel well. And once we get there, then we're really talking about addiction. We're talking about the deep urge throughout our being to connect with a certain thing, substance, experience, person, whatever, with the belief that that thing is the only thing that will make us feel okay or well or happy or alive or awake or even enlightened. So then abstaining from delusion about that which brings about well-being, I think, is an implication of this precept. So in our last few minutes, let's make it more complicated and recognize that everything we come into contact with, every sensory stimulus, changes our state, right? A beautiful sunset changes my state. A cream-filled donut from Donut Dolly down on 49th Street, hand-filled with you know, a substance that they call naughty cream for some reason. Right?
It has bourbon in it.
It has bourbon in it, yeah. Yeah, it's an intoxicant. It's really good, people. Yeah. You know, it changes my state. And not just the bourbon, right? But like the sugar does. I mean, puff pastry changes my state, right? And so as we look at this, first of all, one of the things that's important to me in looking at this is that I feel like I want to extricate myself from the artificial boundaries of legality. Like the fact that alcohol is legal but cannabis isn't is fairly arbitrary, and it's a 20th century thing, right? So it's not, I'm not here saying like, oh, that means you should ignore that and go do something or whatever, but to say that that's not the thing we're looking at, right? If we're looking at what alters my state in a way that the mind is clouded and heedlessness arises, we can talk about a lot of substances, you know, including some very legal ones like sugar and caffeine and, you know, a lot of things, right? The blessed morning coffee. Substances that I at the moment, I've taken to calling the three C's, and I'm contemplating putting out a general challenge to the progressive world to abstain from these things on the basis of globalization and climate change, which is, and I'm hesitating because I don't want to do it myself, which is coffee, chocolate, and coconut. No. Yeah, right? Right? At the very least, fair trade, people. But that doesn't answer the climate issue of shipping things around the world, right? And the fact that the entire globalization enterprise, right, the British Empire itself and the great European empires were motivated by the desire for substances, primarily. Spices, Right? How fond are you of cinnamon and vanilla and pepper? Right? You're fond of the results of the colonization of Madagascar, India, and Indonesia. Right? And so there's a very complex relationship here. Right? Sugar, the thing our bodies like are trained to love the most, right? Simple carbohydrates. But before the hybridization, the radical hybridization of fruit, like wild apples were about as sweet as a carrot. They were small and woody and about as sweet as a carrot, which is great, right? But they were nothing like the ginormous, like, crunchy, sweet Fujis that explode in your head when they're just in season with sweetness. So we're actually a species that has devoted a huge amount of energy and resources to maximizing the pleasure and state-altering qualities we get from substances. Right? The whole slave trade, sugar, right? Sugar cane is a huge part of that. Right? What changed in Europe when they tasted something sweet that wasn't just honey, right? But like, oh, sugar cane.
Or they drink rum.
And they drink rum, right? Which comes from a certain place, right? You know, so, yeah, how much? I saw a whole bit around Brexit and the Scottish saying, essentially, it would be okay to leave Europe, even though we don't want to, because we would lose access to the single market, which is like being able to ship our stuff to Europe. But this this Scottish maker of whiskey said, but you know, I mean, I make whiskey. Like, this is 10% of the Scottish economy. Nobody is going to stop buying whiskey just because it's a little more complicated, right? Like, we're going to be fine, was essentially the message, because our export is so desirable, right? Scotch whiskey. So all of this suggests, I think, to wrap us into, again, an impossible task, is that the precept suggests to us perhaps a kind of strict abstinence that is a very powerful tool, foundation for inquiry into the nature of our desires and habits and supporting deeper spiritual practice. But it also then opens into an inquiry into what's motivating everything we do and how we seek out sensory input for a certain kind of hit of satisfaction, right? The way that, like, the Dolby sound at the action movies has gotten bigger and bigger and bassier, and now when Captain America, like, leaps out of something and lands on the floor of a sort of resonant steel deck of a something, and the entire floor of the theater goes, and I feel it all the way up through my body, and there's a pleasure in that vibration. I'm intoxicated in a certain way by that, right? They figured out how to take something that was like an ordinary sound and blow it up the way that they blew up the sweetness of apples. They blew up the intensity of cannabis. We blow up the intensity of anything that we can, make it stronger and more state-changing. So then, if your goal is clarity of mind, non-cloudedness of mind, there's the layer of, like, caring for our actions so that we're not heedless. There's also the layer of then inquiring into how we care for ourselves in terms of sensory contact in all sorts of ways. And the question of intoxication really speaks to how we get hooked and hypnotized by sensory contact of all kinds. So we can reframe it then to say something like, you know, being quite wary of those sensory experiences that are so strong that they hook us into believing that their effects will be what we think they'll be, something like that. Right, that their effects will be liberative or transformative, or that their effects will be a safe refuge. Thanks for listening. It's a pleasure to investigate. And as we always do, opening the conversation, your reflections. Where does this go for you? What's interesting about it? What's challenging about it for you?
Comment about the addictive quality of what you're discussing being sort of more attached to the moment of wanting, or not the state change itself, but the need.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that very helpful because of both my own experience and my experience with people that I'm close to that have struggled more with forms of addiction, that just taking the problem away doesn't actually cure the problem of addiction.
Yes.
That just gets transferred to another object in some ways.
Yeah.
And then it's hard to, the other part of that that's difficult is, for me, is that that desire is about being, is about the feeling of connectedness or need.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. That seems to me to, like, take us into the sort of murky area of healthy and unhealthy desires.
Yeah.
And a need to feel connected to the world, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, like, I need to feel like I have a relationship to the ice cream shop or to...
Yes.
To the people that are at this party or whatever. And
yeah.
And to decide not to... The abstention then is about, in some ways, about, like, stepping away from the world.
Yes.
And that's fine if you're on retreat, but it's harder out in the world and figuring
absolutely
out what is, like, the discomfort of that experience.
Absolutely. Both of those are really good points, that there's an aspect in the repeated or sort of iterations of grasping at the object that isn't about specifically the object or the state that it gives rise to, but that there's something compelling in the repeated grasping itself. And then the second point, that there's a social component to all of this, right? And that in many cases the thing that we desire is connection, very much. And I like both of those very much. And I would almost add that from the perspective of kind of teachings that lean toward receptivity or clear seeing in relation to the world, one of the things that feels intoxicating or addictive in the use of anything to repeatedly is the illusion that I have agency in relation to my state. That, like, I do these things and they give me the sense that I can intentionally put myself in a better place. That hypnotizes me in a certain way into thinking that I'm more powerful than I am, when what actually is true is that I'm subject to conditions. And part of the painfulness, I think, that even we want to escape from by taking an action like that is the recognition that I am subject to conditions. That's one of the things that's hard to bear about samsara. And so then I find this thing, I'm like, oh, I do this, and I feel instantly better. And that's seems far easier than doing the hard work of actually coming to peace with the degree to which we're powerless in relation to conditions, right? Or could feel powerless. You know, that what we can do is small and perceptual rather than kind of gross. You know, and there's a way that it feels like I can forestall death and sickness, right? I can deny the reality of old age, sickness, and death by pretending that I have agency in relation to them.
It's not a true empowerment.
It's not a true empowerment. Yeah. It's dependent on something that's unreliable, after all, right? You know, once I need an external thing, it may or may not be available, it may or may not be healthy, it may destroy my body, I may act heedlessly.
And you, like, know that deep down.
Yeah.
So it feels crappy.
Right. There's a whole layer of of kind of regret crappiness,
yeah,
on top of the,
yeah,
possible health of, you know, whatever,
yeah,
the various,
yeah,
effects are.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think one of the things that can be possibly like mind-altering is just distraction itself. So
yeah,
I noticed, like, not only am I, you know, I was watching myself at work today, and just this kind of like consistent moving between projects that was keeping me both stressed and unfocused.
Yeah.
But I think that state is actually, like, highly elevated as normal by, like, capitalist society and sort of a consumerist, you know, just constant input of what we could be distracted by at pretty much every moment, you know, especially living in a city. So I was noticing, like, you know, in some ways to, like, take refuge in simplicity is, like, a very sometimes difficult bridge to get to, actually.
Yes.
But once you're there, it can be just, like, an incredible balm, you know, to just kind of release the, you know, whatever the mind-altering thing is, it's sometimes it just feels like it's really just distraction from...
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's just include, you know, scrolling endlessly on Facebook in the list of addictive things.
Yeah.
And there's a whole advertising, you know, kind of structure around, like, you know, what are the advertisers paying for? They're paying for eyeballs, right? They're paying for your time staying on the site. And it is a balm when we land into that simpler or quieter space. It's also painful because I almost think that one of the reasons distraction is so powerful is that it feels good. And it often feels better than confronting what we find when we get still. People will say, like, oh, I got still. You know, people say, I can't meditate because my mind goes crazy. Right? It's this, it's like saying, I can't do yoga because I'm not flexible. Right?
Yeah.
I can't take my medicine because I'm already sick. That's sort of essentially the statement. But it's actually honest in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
It's saying that when I get quiet, what arises for me is that which is painful. Regret, doubt, anxiety, etc. And it's actually just better for me to keep myself busy.
Yeah.
You know? And this is what one teacher of mine calls a heroic strategy, you know, to avoid pain.
Yeah.
But then, you know, of course, in this practice, and if you take on any of these precepts seriously, they will bring you into that more silent place by constraining your actions. And then you'll see what was there, you know, that hurt. And yeah, it's tremendously difficult, I think, now to notice how much we're pulled and how, you know, how deep that is. Yeah, it's one of the reasons why doing it together helps. Do you have your hand?
Yeah, I have the hiccups, so excuse me. I've been thinking a lot about, or wondering a lot about how to distinguish fear that comes from your body's intuitive recognition of real danger versus fear that feels, that's that same physical sensation, but
yeah,
it's something our minds are tricking us into. And
yep.
I had this really frightening experience this week where someone outside of the camp I work at was held up at gunpoint, and I heard her screams and responded to it, and it was actually danger, and it was on my block where I live. And so I've been noticing in my body just these responses to things that are not actually dangerous, just noises or anything.
Sure.
This kind of, I guess, mini PTSD type thing. And so I've been wondering, how do I train myself to recognize which is fear and which is anxiety? What's real danger, and I need to trust my gut, and what's anxiety when it feels exactly the same in my body?
Absolutely.
So I'm very interested if this refraining from substances is in a certain way, Or does it allow us to sort of have a clearer view of what's fear that's self-preservation and what's fear that's anxiety from being in a busy society with violence. And,
for sure.
And, yeah.
It might, you know, who knows, like maybe the, you know, if you're a 9 cups of coffee a day kind of person, that would, you know, that might exacerbate the anxiety sort of thing. But what I think about more, you know, is kind of the basics of trauma physiology, that you have been in a shock or stressful actual danger, based in that the physiology's response is to initiate self-protective motor action and to maintain that until the perception of safety is restored. And so the medicine, in a sense, for what you're describing, which is that, like, the event is over, I feel like I've processed it somewhat, but the physiological responses, especially to this place or sounds, are still there. Of course they are, right? That's really totally natural. The medicine for that, in a sense, is to process somatically or in direct contact with the body those sensations by experiencing them fully while you are in a situation that you perceive as being very safe. In other words, you let yourself go into it, but you stay awake to where you are, knowing full well that you're safe, and you let the threat response meet the reality of safety and some pleasure or ease. And when it meets that reality, it does what it does naturally, which is that it understands that it's no longer needed. I'm giving it an agency. It's really you could call it a chemical response, you know, in the body. Cortisol dissolves, essentially, when it's no longer triggered by new stimulus, is another way to put it. So you would, get to someone who does that kind of work, perhaps, and have a couple sessions. Or, if you wanted to do the cheap route, you get your friend who loves you and cares for you to just sit down in a safe, quiet space with you, and you tell the story slowly of what happened, and you see the images and you feel the responses, and they're there so that you don't freak out and go too far. And you just very slowly, kind of bit by bit, feel the vibration in your body that is that thing. And you let it, as soon as it comes up, you stay with it and let it subside. And you probably feel it a little bit right now, even as we're talking about it. So then your practice will be just to know where you are, to stay in the circle, in a sense, and to stay with the vibration in your body and just allow it, knowing that you're safe here, to the extent that you do know that. And they will subside, right? It's their nature, in a sense, to do so. If they stick with you, kind of go to someone or come for a session and sort of just address it directly. And they're actually pretty easy to dissolve, you know. You're safe. You came through it.
Yeah.
You know.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And not to impress on it too much, but I'm having a follow-up question of what if you now have a belief that nowhere is safe? That, like, there's certain, like, this room feels safe, but in a place where there is a lot of country, where there's a lot of gun violence, like, how do you sort of, in those, when you actually are in this
Absolutely. Room? You have to learn to discern where you are. And it might help to, you know, not spend too much time on the street for a little while. In other words, give yourself the support of putting yourself in really, really safe spaces for a while, as best you can, right? You live wherever you live, etc. But, you know, be a little sheltered for a bit, because it's the perception of that shelter that will allow the physiology to subside. Once the physiology subsides, if you can let it really land as fully as possible, the street won't be triggering. The trigger is there because the physiological response is still active. And the way you know it's done is that you can return. Not shut down to the feelings, but actually open to the reality of your street, which is that it's not always dangerous. In fact, mostly not. Right? If it was mostly, it would be a war zone and you wouldn't live there. So you actually start to perceive reality again, rather than perceiving the imagination that it's dangerous, which is based on being stuck in the memory of a single moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah,
for sure. We can talk more about that as you. Anything else on intoxicants, and we'll call it a night. It's about our time. Right. T?
Yeah.
Please, sir.
I've been hearing, and I've also been kind of sharing this with, like, when someone is struggling with, you know, meditating, but it's just overwhelming to go inside, they are in some sort of trauma vortex or something, and so
yeah. The
kind of teaching instruction is to then don't just do the standard, we're going to pay attention to breath and body, but like come out, ideally orient towards safety or whatever.
Yeah.
But I've also been hearing it as like some people are suggesting like just anything you can do to get out of that trauma, go look at Netflix, Facebook, like... Mm-hmm. How does that fit? Like, are those actually good options, or is it more like, you know, only just do wholesome things, orient towards nature and the room, or is something
I've totally told people to, like, just go watch a movie, you know? And it's that level of it is a little bit like any port in a storm, mm-hmm. you know? Like, that's a level of freak out where, you know, someone's, like, essentially saying, I can't feel about or think about anything other than absolute crisis constantly. I have no break. It's killing me. You're like, watch a movie. Just get out of it. Doesn't matter, right? The metaphor that the Buddha gives is, he says, just as a skilled carpenter removes a coarse peg by means of a finer one, so does the meditator remove a coarse state by means of a finer state. So again, if we're always talking about state shift, and we are, which is why this precept is in there, the state of being kind of hypnotized slightly by, you know, trying to watch every episode of you know, Star Trek Voyager, and there's a lot of them, right? That state would be preferable to having a panic attack. Having saved myself from a panic attack by watching 200 episodes of Star Trek Voyager. I think Deep Space Nine was better, but, you know, whatevs, like, whatever's your flavor. Then one could say, okay, I did that. Now I'm in a state that's predominantly dull and kind of washed out. So then we're going to be like, okay, so now dump the Netflix and go for a hike, which is going to be slightly more internal, meaning, in a sense, oriented to the actual space you're in. Because Netflix is only oriented toward an imaginary space. Oriented to the actual space. Oh, I feel good hiking. Awesome. Now how about, you know, going to yoga and being in a room and intending something in your body, but keep your eyes open and move around a lot, listen to the rock and roll, and, you know, say hi to people. So you're coming closer to the thing. But you could take it in a lot of steps, right? And so the yoga class is going to be a finer peg than, you know, just a meandery walk. And then, you know, walking meditation is going to be a finer peg than a yoga class with music, right? And sitting in meditation is going to be a finer peg than walking meditation. But sit with your eyes open first, you know. And I had a client once who came to me and said, I can't do yoga or meditate. I said, why? She said, because when you say the words go inside, I freak out. Like, I don't even go inside. Just the words themselves terrify me. I was like, cool. I'm not going to tell you to do that. What I want you to do is I want you to tell me 10 things in the room. Right? I did a basic orientation thing. She did that. We played this. I said, and now that you've told me 10 things in the room, I want you to look down and see your foot and rub it on the rug and tell me what that sensation is. And she's like, you're tricking me to get me to go inside. And I'm like, of course I am. But all you're going to do is rub your foot on the rug. You can do that. And she's like, oh, yeah, it's scratchy. I was like, awesome, right? We did this for, you know, 3 weeks, hardly anything, a few times. She was like, and after a few weeks of this, I was like, okay, so now I want you to look around outside. I'm going to use the word. And now I want you to tell me about a couple of sensations happening inside. And she was like, hey, you said the word inside and I didn't freak out. Right? And basically, I did what we're talking about. Like, we made the safe space for contacting the difficult thing until it could be contacted without spilling over, you know. And that was pretty easy in a certain way. And now she's like, oh my God, I meditate all the time. I love it. So, you know, not all of our ailments are that easily fixed, but that's the direction, right? Is do whatever you got to do. But then once there's some stability, if we're going toward meditation anyway, and maybe a follow-up to your question is, I don't assume that everyone's going to be helped by sitting in meditation, going inward. So like, that person might be like, do Netflix, and then walk in the woods, and then do a really physical like exercise practice, and then really get oriented in the space, and don't go further than that. You know, it could be almost like, okay, now you go and do Aikido for 10 years, and then we'll talk about meditating. Right, do something that's like spatial and relational and social and devotional, right? Like, oh, don't sit in meditation. Just go to big kirtans and sing the name of God over and over and over. It's external. It's externally oriented. God is out there, not inside here, not in my belly where the fear lives. You know it. So for some folks, it's like, yeah, 10 years down the way, maybe you'll meditate if you want to. But there's not the idea that it's the best medicine for everybody, you know, and especially in relation to trauma. Yeah, right on. It's a good question. So, thank you for your presence and your warm attention, your kindness. We'll talk about the first precept, taking life, causing harm, etc., and we'll kind of umbrella the whole precepts thing. Next time, maybe to cap off the precept series, I'll bring in a little bit of the kind of Mahayana tantric view of the precepts orienting around emptiness and kind of radical non-dualism. So we'll see if it goes there. We are, as always, operating within the radical and strange practice of the gift economy here. So This group and practice is offered fully on the basis of your joy in being here, and to the extent that you have the financial and resource access to be able to support a group like this happening, that support is necessary for it to go on. So your generosity is both warmly appreciated and is the cause for the continuation of this. So thank you for everything you offer. Donations go in the little basket and get split in half between the studio and myself. So thanks for being here. Thanks for folding blankets neatly. If you'd like to stack them in color-coded stacks, you know, no one would mind, except the people that do, you know. And I'll see you next week. Take good care.